KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Coming up, a theater piece brings the country's first known act of militant queer resistance against police brutality back to life.
They died not getting endorsed by the universe. I want to give that to them.
Then, how are interracial relationships faring in the era of Black Lives Matter?
It acts as this barometer. I expect you to have some opinion on this, and whatever your opinion is, I'm going to feel that that is reflective of something about you as a person.
And a Bay Area photographer uses her camera to give back to her community.
You just want to make sure that their image is going to be reflected as who they are.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. New York's Stonewall Riots of 1969 are often cited as the spark that lit the nation's contemporary gay liberation movement. But before Stonewall, there were queer rebellions around the country. The Compton's Cafeteria Riot is one such uprising. But for decades, the riot was lost to history. Few people knew about the courageous drag queen who fought back against police with a cup of hot coffee, or the transgender woman who took to the streets that night. But now a theater piece is bringing that act of resistance back to life. KALW's Holly J. McDeed has more.
Summer's here and the time is right for dancing in the street. We're dancing in Chicago, right here in New Orleans.
During a rehearsal at the Tenderloin Museum, actors are reenacting a riot that erupted at Gene Compton's cafeteria more than half a century ago. In this scene, it's a hot August night in 1966. Drag queens, transgender women, and street hustlers are dancing and singing when a cop walks in.
What kind of clown act is going on here now? Of course you can't act like human beings because you're not.
In the scene, an officer tries to arrest a character named Rusty for female impersonation.
That's it. Turn around. You're under arrest. Come here.
So Rusty, played by Shane Zaldivar, throws a cup of coffee in the cop's face.
No! Oh, quiet, freak!
Forks and knives flew in the air, and tables were turned upside down. As actress Kelly J. Kelly explained in the scene, the fight spilled out into the street.
We won't take it! We won't take it! We won't take it!
It seemed like 100 screaming queens showed up out of nowhere with all their collective rage uncorked. But we busted everything in sight. We burned a cop car. Some queen threw an M80 in the gas tank. It just blew.
Drag queen Donna Persona is one of three people who collaborated on the script. Raised by a Baptist minister, she was taught from an early age that being a gay or transgender person was wrong.
It was against the law, supposedly, to impersonate a woman. I would open a medical book, and I saw that it was an illness or an anomaly, and something that needed to be removed from your psyche somehow.
So in the mid-60s, when she was 18 years old, Donna Persona would take the Greyhound bus from San Jose to the corner of Turk and Taylor in the Tenderloin to Gene Compton's cafeteria.
This is Compton's here, right here.
The diner isn't much now, just a big building with boarded up doors. But back then, it was like a 24-hour portal to another world. It was jam-packed with night owls, sipping cups of coffee that cost less than a dime. Transgender people weren't welcome in the gay bars nearby, so they went to Compton's.
So I came here, and I'm normal. It was better than Disneyland, better than the Paris or whatever. We had to not tell the world at large about this, because then they would destroy it for us or something.
Every great city of the world seems to have an area given over to the fleshly needs of men. In San Francisco, this area is called the Tenderloin. It is a marketplace of vice, degradation, and human misery.
Donna That's from a 1970 program produced by Kron TV. Many of the trans women Donna Persona befriended lived in a crowded Tenderloin hotel room and did what they could to survive.
I learned that they were sex workers, and they took and sold drugs. They were shoplifters, and they were all wonderful people.
Compton's was like a late-night office where they could come down from highs, gossip, and warn each other about police or angry Johns. They just wanted to be themselves, but the world wanted them to be a gender they did not identify with. It was nearly impossible for transgender people to find work.
No, they would love to have been a school teacher if they could do it as a woman. You know, give me all my rights and I'll pick something else. But, you know, they had to sleep somewhere at night. And the only thing there for them was streetwalking.
Donna Persona was hanging out with a rough crowd. One night, she was riding in a car with her drug dealer boyfriend, and someone shot at them. She quit the scene, discovered LSD, became a hippie, and moved on. She had no way of knowing that soon afterwards, the Compton's cafeteria queens rebelled. Newspapers ignored it.
Nobody gave a hoot. I'm going to be nice and not talk dirty. But basically, nobody cared about these people anywhere. Their families, the public, and certainly not City Hall. The whole story was buried as though it never happened.
Until it was unearthed by Susan Stryker. She's now a gender and women's studies professor. Back in the 90s, while in the process of transitioning from male to female, she yearned to find a real-life story about trans people that described more than hormone therapy and surgery.
Trans people have existed. It's like we've been marginalized and oppressed. It's like we have to have, like we come together and founded organizations and been involved in political campaigns and been involved in struggle against oppressive forms of power. It's like that story has got to be there.
After paging through files of old newspapers and pamphlets at the GLBT Historical Society, she found a mention of a riot in a program from the 1972 Pride Parade. That's ancient history when it comes to queer rights.
So when I came across this story, I thought, this is it. To have it not be a story of medicine and psychiatry, but a story of people finding the ability to live in the world the way that they want to live.
Stryker spent the next few years piecing together that story. Then, in 2005, she released a documentary called Screaming Queens to set the record straight about the Compton's cafeteria uprising.
So frequent were the fights between Screaming Queens in the 2 to 3 a.m. period that police, even in permissive San Francisco, had had enough and asked an all-night cafeteria to close by midnight.
It wasn't a catfight between Screaming Queens. It was a riot, and it kicked off a new movement for human rights.
It was the summer before the Summer of Love. Stryker says that as the Vietnam War escalated, more soldiers and sailors went to the Tenderloin to buy sex. So in an effort to clean up the city, police raids intensified. Members of the Vanguard, a radical gay advocacy group, pushed back, like in this scene from the play.
We are the Vanguard, and we are going to stand our ground. We're going to walk down the streets with our heads held high. With dignity. With dignity, we can change things.
Vanguard members were inspired by social justice organizers a few blocks away at Glide Memorial Church, anti-war protesters across the bay in Berkeley, and civil rights marchers on the other side of the country. But what put things in motion was that dramatic moment right out of a movie, or in this case, right off the stage, a drag queen splashing a cup of coffee in a cop's face.
We felt our power that night, our collective rage. And in that moment, we forgot our differences and became a bomb ready to explode. And we did.
After the riot, things quietly began to improve for transgender people in San Francisco. They gave talks at the police academy. Charities like the Salvation Army and public health staffers worked more closely with the trans community.
You know, it was, you know, a pretty remarkable network of things that came out of trans people on the streets pushing back against the police and, you know, insisting in a new way on their ability to, you know, to exist in public.
Donna Persona had left town before all this. She was able to escape the Tenderloin because she had a loving family in San Jose to go back to. She says she co-wrote the Compton's Cafeteria play in order to honor the people who couldn't leave.
Did I say this before? They were born, they lived, and then they died. Not getting endorsed by the universe. They didn't get that. But I, Colette Legrand, Mark Nasser, want to give that to them.
In the Compton's Cafeteria play, a character named Vicky reflects on the riot from the present day.
Back then, it was different, so different. And yet today, the still same battle still rages on. Back then, we were battling for a few blocks of dignity. Today, the battle is for a country.
After the upheaval, activists made progress until eventually, finally, being gay or transgender was no longer a crime.
But still, how many transgender people were murdered this year and last year? For what? For being themselves, which still, unfortunately, in this country, is an act of courageousness.
San Francisco city officials plan to establish the country's first transgender cultural district in the Tenderloin. And right now, if you wander by Turk and Taylor, you'll see a sign that says Gene Compton's Cafeteria Way. But that still leaves out the part about the riot. In the Tenderloin, for Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
The theater piece called The Compton's Cafeteria Riot is running at the New Village Cafe until March 17th. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Scholars from around the country are at UC Berkeley this week for a conference exploring racial justice. It's called Race and Inequality in America, the Kerner Commission at 50. It refers to the commission created in 1968 by President Johnson to investigate the race riots of 1967 and explore frustrations in Black communities. This week, we're talking with some of the speakers. Chantel Bugs is a social scientist from Florida State University. Her research explores the intersection of personal relationships and racial justice activism. Last year, she interviewed dozens of women to see if civic involvement mattered for those whom they choose to date. She published a study called Dating in the Time of Black Lives Matter, exploring mixed-race women's discourses of race and racism. I caught up with Bugs in her office. First, I asked her what was happening at the time she did the research.
In Texas, where I did this research, you know, in Austin, San Antonio, and Houston, when I was going into the field to collect data and do these interviews, it was, you know, Sandra Bland's, you know, death had recently happened, and there was a pool party in Dallas where a young Black girl, you know, was thrown to the ground in a swimsuit, you know, by a police officer, and several other incidents, you know, that had occurred. And so I was doing interviews and people kept bringing it up. And so some women started talking about how they like would literally say, well, what do you think about this case? And they would like show the, like one girl's telling me how she's like, you know, on a date with a guy and she like pulls up the video of the pool party. And she's like, what are your thoughts on this? And it just became very clear that it acts as this barometer. It's like, I expect you to have some opinion on this. And whatever your opinion is, I'm going to feel that that is reflective of something about you as a person, you know, and your values. So what became very clear to me also, right, is not only was this kind of literally shaping, right, these broader discourses about Black Lives Matter and the movement and police brutality, right, and what's going on in our country, you know, are really shaping how everyday people talk about race. And, you know, it's not just, you know, the news media or the political pundits. Like, we're literally having these conversations in our, you know, everyday, like, interactions. And the burden of how to even utilize it, right, and bring it up became much more, it was evident to me that it was more significant for women who could not pass into whiteness. So women who were mixed with Black, also, you know, women who were, who identified as having, you know, Arab background. So, you know, they kind of tied it to their experiences with Islamophobia. So basically, if you were visibly, you know, a person of color, right, and could not pass into whiteness, like, you know, you kind of wanted to know where people stood on this because you would extrapolate from that.
Did you feel like Black Lives Matter or like the current situation, the current atmosphere specifically is challenging mixed race relationships?
I think it is. And I think, you know, not just for multiracial women, I think people across the board, whether they, you know, hold certain politics where they care about these issues, even if they are not Black or people of color. And I think certainly, you know, if they're people of color, I think that, you know, people are, lots of people, you know, have expressed to me. So like I'd written a blog post version of that article before that article was published. And I remember it was kind of making its rounds on social media. And I had all kinds of people telling me, yeah, like this is a thing that I do, you know. And I remember OkCupid actually instituted a match question shortly after I had finished collecting data. So I was already in analysis at that point. But they had a question, you know, that pops up that's like blank lives matter. And the two options to choose from are Black or all, right? So I'm like, someone suggested a question, right, about Black Lives Matter. It became a match question. I would love to know, you know, how people are answering that.
Right. But if it wasn't important, if it wasn't a factor that they're seeing as important, they wouldn't have put it up there.
Yeah, you know, and I think that this, you know, this stuff matters to people. Mm-hmm. And I think that someone who wants to date interracially, you know, or interethnically even in, you know, the current, you know, U.S. Western world that we live in, because I don't even think this would be just a problem just here in the States, right? Like, you know, I mean, I think with Brexit and the rise of the right in Germany and in France and, you know, and, you know, how people feel about, you know, refugees coming over from North Africa. I think that these tensions are, you know, are a lot of places, right? I don't think it's just the U.S. And so I think that it just contributes to some of the extra work, right, that people have to do to be in a caring relationship. I personally just do not believe that you can have a relationship across socially constructed boundaries, right, without, you know, having to thoughtfully contend with what those boundaries mean, how those boundaries impact you and your partner's life. And when that starts to break down is when people have issues. And, you know, I can't tell you countless, you know, multiracial people I know who have white moms and like the struggles they have because the white moms are so caught up in their whiteness, you know. So, you know, I think there are a lot of people who think that just because you have sexual or romantic or familial intimacy with a person of a different race, that that automatically means you're not racist or not prejudiced or that you can't perpetuate inequality.
Yeah.
That for me is super important, is to like illustrate how we're not going to be saved by mixed race people. We're not going to be saved by interracial relationships. Like, you know, even if people, you know, do all the work, you know, that those relationships require, is those in and of themselves, right, are not going to undo, you know, the patriarchy and white supremacy and all of these other, you know, larger systems that, you know, you create, right, and create inequality in our lives.
That's Chantel Bugs, assistant professor of sociology at Florida State University. She's in town as part of UC Berkeley's conference, Race and Inequality in America, the Kerner Commission at 50. We'll link to her research at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Jean Melisane grew up all over the Bay Area, but she picked up her love of photography in San Jose, working for the media collective Silicon Valley Debug. Jean's work ranges from documentary photography to personal portraiture. Whether her camera's pointed at her queer Pacific Islander community or a Black Lives Matter protest, her eye is always drawn to the way people thrive despite the struggles they're facing. She came to KALW Studios to talk about the power and responsibility of documenting people's stories.
The way I discovered photography was like pretty random. Sprint had come out with the first like camera phone. It's terrible quality, but everybody was like super excited. And you know, I was still in high school. I bought my brother and me the camera phone right when it came out. And you know, no one had cell phones back then. So it was only me and him calling each other in high school, you know? And we would take pictures, and my older cousin, he would see all these photos on my cell phone, and he was just saying, you should consider photography. He was like the first dude that ever said that. But it wasn't until I left down to San Jose and went to college, Evergreen Valley College, and I took a photography class. I got to meet this community organization called Debug through that school. And Debug was a community media organization, but they do so much more. They work with families of folks who are incarcerated. They work on lowering their sentencing. So I really got to learn everything from all these folks who work there. Like, they used to have this photo circle. You know, I didn't know any photographers growing up. So, you know, it was just dope to be around folks who were really passionate about people, passionate about community. I try to practice all the time this concept of conscious photography. So conscious photography comes from like being more intentional about photos you take. You don't just like take the photo and move on. Like, you can actually shift someone's life through photo. You know, photographs kind of capture a timeline. That's why folks love looking back. You know, there's a connection of where you're at now to then. I did this show at Oakland Museum with Pacific Islander families in the Bay Area. We went to Diamond Park and we were there doing a kava ceremony, ava ceremony. So ava is like a root and it gets dried out and shaved into a powder and folks drink it in a ceremonial way. And so we went with this family and it's probably like 30 of them. And they all come out, they all show up. And the women are creating tapa, which is like a bark cloth. It's found across most of the Pacific Islands. It's probably one of the biggest practices. You can see the family's name is written on there usually, and you can see the date, or you can see the village. And then when it's passed down, it kind of holds every, you know, every single thing. So when you pass it down and you can see the name and the family and the village. So like this family, they all came out. And so we did this ava ceremony and I took this photo and there was an elder in that photo. And he passed away. When he passed away, I went to go print all these photos for them. But they used a photo for his headstone. When I seen that photo on the headstone, I seen it through Instagram. I'm friends with all of his kids on Instagram. And so I was like, that's exactly why I take photos. The way that you capture images in a certain light, people need to see themselves like that, you know? Because sometimes people don't see themselves in that kind of light. You know, I've been to funerals where you see on the program, I've seen like someone use a terrible pixelated image of an ID. That kind of looked like a mugshot. And I'm just like that, you know, like we just need to take photos of our folks. Cause you know, like it lets you know that someone like yourself exists. Like I remember growing up and you know, you're always trying to identify somebody on television, you know, even if it was like terrible role that you saw someone in, you know, you're just like, oh, look at that guy. You know that there's like a connection there. It's important for folks to know that, you know, they could be in galleries. You're just trying to make right of your folks, you know, the folks that you grew up with, that you know personally. You just want to make sure that their image is going to be reflected as who they are.
That was photographer Jean Melisane. She's currently a film student at City College. That piece was produced by Jackie Sajiko. You can see the photos that Jean was talking about at our website, klw.org. Click Cross Currents. And that's our show. The Cross Currents team includes Asal Hassanipour, Janae Darden, Raquel Maria Dillon, Lisa Morehouse, Zaina Nasser Truknewin, Andrew Stelzer, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Gabe Graben, and Jackie Sajiko. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Graham LeBron. Graham will perform as Golden Graham at the Hemlock tomorrow night. Show starts at 8:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.